the whole tree. If there's a registered voter in the wrong town on the same sheet that's devoted to a particular town, the whole sheet's thrown out. So these are things that professional gatherers understand, volunteers, by the nature of the learning curve, being a volunteer, tend to, there's a large error margin on that.
Dodge Stahl, if we don't make it in 2012, the list that we have already compiled, the list of names and contacts, will make 2014 much, much easier.
That's
because
correct.
Because we will know those same people will almost certainly sign up again, and we won't have to go through all kinds of hoops to accumulate them again.
That's correct. But we generally will not have their emails. We will have to actually write them snail mail. We'll have their address, and who knows if they move by then. But still, it's a very valuable list.
Yeah, let me remind people why that's important. Even though our current tactical goal is to get one of the states at least on the ballot and passed in 2012, the other states are going to be important after the fact in order to sign on to join powers with that state and help empower it from without. So even though they may not be the first state, the fact is at some point or another, each state will, with an initiative law, we hope, will be able to do its own campaign and sign on and link up with it and therefore make it more powerful. So it's just as important in 2014 as it is in 2012 in terms of the aggregate empowerment of the commission.
Can I jump in? I have a question. It's Craig McKee.
Craig.
I just wanted to, I wondered, did we start at some point using professional people and then stop partway and switch to strictly volunteers just because of the cost, or what happened there?
Susan?
That's correct. Yes. We had not actually signed the contract because the money wasn't there yet, but the professional petition gatherer, we had reached out to them. They actually gave us a lot of valuable advice and actually collected all 100,000 petitions from the state, and I picked them up from him, and he was waiting in the wings, and unfortunately the money just never came through. But he was extremely helpful, and I'm sure next time around he'll definitely be a consideration for working with us again.
Okay.
Actually, okay. Any other questions on the Citizen Title 11 Commission before we move on?
Ken, this is Danny Isley. You had said that there was a new page on the website regarding the plan, a strategic plan. And
not yet. It won't be on tomorrow. Okay.
Oh, it's not on right now.
No, it'll be up tomorrow.
But you sent it to the listserv, so it's
The listserv was I did send a copy to the listserv of the strategic plan. Yes.
Okay. And did you call it the strategic plan?
It was a response to, I think, Paul Zaremka's request for it.
Okay. I'll look for it.
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
Okay. Hearing no other questions, then we can go ahead and move on to our first. I should say, because we just started recording late, this is the October 26th meeting of the 9/11 Truth teleconference. Kent Freeland facilitating, Annie Isley, secretary. Our first item on the agenda tonight, by special invitation, Ken Jenkins is going to give us a brief primer on how we can use local cable access channel to help promote our cause. Kent did ask me to send around, and I did, on the draft agenda, two URLs for people to do some briefing on beforehand to be prepared for his presentation. Hopefully others have had a chance to do that. And, Ken, go ahead.
Yeah. Thanks, Ken. The two links that I sent around pretty much deal with an answer, hopefully, most or all of the questions you may have. So I'm not going to repeat that. If you're interested, you obviously can go to those links and get the information. The basic thing I want to emphasize is that we have found over the years, and as part of 9/11 TV, I've been doing cable access outreach of our 9/11 information for quite a number of years, and we have real feedback of how effective it is. It is really one of the better ways to reach out to beyond the choir and to reach out in an economical way to our fellow citizens to educate them on our issue. So as a methodology, I really do consider it one of our best. And so that's kind of my primary message. In terms of implementing it, the basic message is that every local cable system has different rules and different guidelines to get stuff on the air. And so the first step is simply to contact your local cable station when whatever city or county you're in, and get that information from them, and then you'll know what you need to do to get things formatted for the particular cable system that you're trying to get on. Some require very specific links, others are more flexible, for instance. So that's my kind of brief pitch on it. I guess I'm mostly here to answer any questions you may have about that, since the information is available on the web.
Ken, could you, this is Anna Yeisley, could you state those two links so I could put them in the minutes?
They're on the draft agenda.
Very good.
Yeah, and one of them is from AE, from Architects and Engineers. They do have an active committee working on cable access, so they have a good summary on their website.
I have a question. This is Susan in Worcester. Is the link, do you have an account with PEG Media? Because a lot of cable access channels link very easily and efficiently and downloadable to PEG Media.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up, Susan. PEG is an acronym. I can't remember exactly what it stands for, but it's basically a way to upload files, video files, and download them so that you don't have to use physical media to get your videos into the cable stations. And,
makes it very easy for activists as well to link their cable access to PEG Media.
Yeah, exactly. It saves a lot of money and shipping and everything else. So I think that's covered fairly well on one or both of the two URLs. So again, for the details, I would recommend going there. But do be familiar with that term and look for it, because it's the way things are moving.
Could you spell that, please, Tim?
PEG, P-E-G? It's an acronym, P-E-G.
Okay. Thanks.
This is Dwayne Dietz.
Can you give
some examples of the feedback that you've gotten that indicate this is an effective way of getting the word out?
Well, the main feedback that I have is personal, and then basically it's this, that I, as I say, have been doing this for many years, and of all the many different 9/11 videos we've gotten onto some of our local cable access. I was living in Marin County at the time that this informal information was gathered. I would go places like the post office or the grocery store in town wearing my 9/11 t-shirts or whatever, and people would come up to me, or even sometimes when I wasn't wearing that, and they just total strangers would come up to me various places, even literally on the street, saying, I saw you on cable TV. Now, considering that I personally appeared in probably well under 10%, probably under 5% of all the videos that we post, I'm thinking, given the numbers of people that would come up to me, And if you kind of run the numbers on, you know, A, they had to see the show, they had to remember it, they had to remember me, they had to see me on the street, they had to take, you know, time out to encounter me. Those are a lot of filters, and if you run the numbers backwards, we have to be reaching many thousands of people with these videos, and that's, of course, again, just in one county. But based on that feedback alone, I just know that we're reaching a lot of people.
Very interesting.
I think that's really the way to go, is trickle up rather than trickle down. Go to your local channels, go to your local media. That's a very easy way to get the message out, and it does trickle up.
I have a
Could I add story. A personal experience to the cable access?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
I have a cable access story. Many municipalities televise their city council meetings, and if you are in that area, if you are a resident, anyone has the right to speak for a certain number of minutes on anything, and get your face on television. I did that here in Florissant, Missouri, and the very next day I was walking to the grocery store and a man hailed me in the parking lot and said, "Aren't you the guy that stood up at the council meeting last night about 9/11? So the atmosphere in the meeting itself isn't as important as the fact that you got 9/11. On TV.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Interesting.
Can I add something? It's Barbara.
Yeah. Barbara, go ahead.
Yeah. Two quick points. One of them is a personal experience like Ken's, and the other is a question, actually, to Ken. The first is I retired from about 15 years at the Naval Postgraduate School on July 1st. And but prior to that, I was there for 15 years, and for 10 of those, I've been doing public speaking, local TV, radio, holding events, et cetera, like many of us. And interestingly, just as I believe it was Susan said, people are coming out of the woodwork. They were even coming out of the woodwork inside a military base. I mean, after being on public access TV, I would walk through the gate in the morning, and the guy who rotates around, like everything in the military, they would say, they would put a thumbs up and say, "Saw you on public access, saw you on AMP, which is our Access Monterey Peninsula last night," and put a thumbs up and ask when, you know, when the next 9/11 thing was going to be on. So, you know, public access TV really works. Now, my question to Ken is, the big hurdle that we have here in the Monterey Peninsula, and it's probably true in any cable access TV station or area in the country, and that is, there is no good way to know well enough in advance. In a public forum, like your local newspaper will print every single morning, you'll know what's going to be on TV for the rest of the day. In your TV schedule, the local public access TV is not part of that local TV schedule. And part of the reason is when you call the local access TV station, public access TV station, the people who administer it will tell you, "Well, that's a problem because we can at any time we can change our schedule." Well, you know, that's true for any TV station. So the big question is, what is the best way, and maybe that can be answered online, Jen, to save time here, but how do you get the schedule for your AMP program advertise at least 24 or as much as in advance as possible so you can organize around it?
Well, Barbara, I wish I had a good answer for you there. There is no magic formula that I'm aware of. The truth of the matter is that a majority of people that ever see anything on public access kind of arrive by surfing rather than any deliberate intent, which is one of the reasons it's so amazing that we get the feedback we do about being seen on these shows, on these stations, because, it's just a pretty much a random thing.
Well, I do understand that. That's the reason I raised it, because it would be such a great organizing tool, and we would increase even our numbers of viewers if we could get the program out there so that people who see a 9/11 program and want to see it will also be part of the audience. That's my question. Yeah.
Well, I totally agree with the ideal. There obviously are the usual outlets that we can use in terms of our own publicity lists, and we can get the schedule and send it out via email. But that's, number one, generally preaching to the choir, and number two is not the best. But I think we really have to kind of trust and rely on the fact that people do see these things. And if anyone else has any ideas, I'm sorry, I don't have more. And there may be a little
Excellent.
Bit of information online as well.
Please share them.
This is Susan in Worcester again. Social media, Facebook, Twitter, etc. Once you have the role from the public access, and that's important to follow up when you submit this to public access and they say, yes, we're going to run it, then you follow up and say, when? get the role, and you can create a Facebook event. You can put it out on Twitter. You don't have to preach to the choir. You can put this out, for example, for Worcester. I've joined a bunch of Worcester groups that have nothing to do with 9/11. And you just put that out there. So, it can get out there with a campaign, a publicity campaign.
Yes, I do know that. Thank you very much. My question was really, how do you get it in the local paper at least 24 hours in advance? But, maybe there's no way.
Well, if you have the roll call in time from the cable access, and every cable access is different in terms of how well organized they are. It's just a matter of follow-up. It's not a guarantee because of the organization of the public access channel themselves, but it's a hedge. You hedge your bets.
Okay,
this is Sheldon. Produced actually a TV here locally on our local access channel. It's pretty easy to do. Doesn't have to be straight. We had quite a few number of programs on 9/11, directly on that, and also things online. The station will usually have a website where the schedule is listed at least 2 or 3 days in advance. And to my surprise, I had tried to get the local paper to carry the schedule. They just told me it was no way, and then a couple later, the station, the listing started coming out in the paper on a daily basis. So it just depends, I guess, on the management station and how squeaky wheel publicity you can get on it.
Exactly.
Okay, any other comments or questions for Jan about this?
I had a great deal of trouble getting movies and programs on my cable in the St. Louis area. The cable company can throw up any kind of obstacle in your way. But if your municipality is already televising their city council meetings, the cable company cannot do anything about that. And your municipality cannot legally prevent you from using your allotted 3 minutes to say your piece, or however many minutes they give you.
Good.
You mean during a town meeting or something?
Yes.
Okay, that's very good.
Good point. Okay, any other comments or questions before we move on? If not, Ken, thank you very much for bringing your expertise with us to us and answering questions. Can folks write you if they have further questions, if they wish?
I just wanted to mention I'm reblasting the cable access TV, so check your email.
Okay. Thanks. Okay. Let's move on then to, thanks again, Kent, for that presentation.
Sure.
We're going now into the discussion mode, and we have a number of topics that have been designated for discussion this evening by request of members. Each one of them will be given about 10 minutes of discussion, and then we'll move on so that we can treat all of them. We have, I think, four separate topics. The first one is updates on the Pentagon hearings. If anybody has any updates on the Pentagon hearings, this one is not a time comment, but the question has been raised, does anybody have any update information on those Pentagon hearings that were originally scheduled for 11-11-11? Does anybody know anything about those?
Yeah, George and this is Anna Yeisley. George and I were working on getting that by November. After being at the Toronto hearings, George said, "Well, we're going to need a lot more." The idea was to fashion them after the Toronto hearings, but apparently it was a bigger deal than what we had time to do. So it's kind of been put on the back burner. I guess I haven't. I'll contact George and report back as to what we're going with that, and so. I've kind of dropped out this last month. I've been busy doing some local activities, so I've dropped the ball on it. If anyone has any ideas, love to hear them.
So it sounds like nobody's actively pursuing it at this time that you know of, right?
Right, not at this point.
Okay. Any other comments on that before we move on to our first discussion topic? Okay, the first one is feedback from participants in the Toronto hearings. Specifically requested were feedback from, is Paul Jaremka on the call?
Yes, I am.
Good, okay.
I am.
Barbara and Paul, particularly people wanted to hear their take on the Toronto hearings. So let's see, Barbara, would you like to go first?
Okay, I think probably the most efficient way is to answer people's questions, especially people who weren't there. I personally think that having been there, I believe that it was an historic event. Time will tell, but David Ray Griffin actually said at the hearing.
Barbara, what did you say? I'm sorry, I missed it too. It was a what event?
Oh, I think it was an historic event, a turning point event, a watershed event. David Ray Griffin said that himself during the hearing on the videotape, which hopefully you can see online, and I'll let you know how to see those, and unfortunately not yet many of the talks online, but just some of them, the testimony. But during the hearings, David Ray Griffin actually said that he believed that in the future when we look back, we will be able to say, it happened in Toronto. That's when it happened. So that just kind of sums it up. I think I know that my presentation was phenomenally received. I don't know if anyone has seen it online. What I will do if you haven't seen it online is a little bit later this evening I will send the links to my testimony online and the Q&As from the panelists who I call the jury or the judges. And that included what probably will make it historic is that the report is being written by four panelists, four judges, four jurors, whatever you want to call them, and one of them is the honorary president of the Supreme Court of the country of Italy. So that really raised us to a whole new level. And at the end of the hearings, this part is online. In fact, if you go to the Toronto hearings website and you click on schedule, on the menu on schedules, and then go to that page. I think it's called Schedules and Online Streaming or Live Streaming. Click on that Schedules and Live Streaming link on the menu, and then the page that comes up, click on the first of the two links. And when that second page comes up, the large screen on the left, start that video. And not at the beginning of the video, but about halfway into the video, is the final event of the hearings, of the 4 days of the hearings. And that is the feedback from the four judges, panelists, jurors, whatever you call them themselves. And during that panelist panel, the honorary president of the Supreme Court of Italy stated very clearly, it's hard to hear his English because it's broken English, but he's very, very intelligent and extremely knowledgeable already about 9/11, very knowledgeable. He said words to the effect, see it for yourself, please. He said words to the effect that, well, there needs to be an official proceeding with under oath testimony and subpoena power in the United States. If there is not, we will have to take it to the International Criminal Court, the ICC, and he explained that the United States does not need to be a signatory nation, which we are not yet, of course, unfortunately, in order for that to work. So it really, and just very briefly, my own testimony was a small miracle. I was originally asked to speak for 10 minutes, then it went to 15, then it went to 20, then it went to 25, plus Q's and A's. And at the end of my presentation on the Pentagon attack, and I was explicitly asked not to address the planes, but simply to put the best evidence that the official story must be false based upon everything else. And, of course, my work is on inside explosives, and inside explosives at least 6.5 minutes before the official story says anything impacted the building, no matter what it was. So that was my testimony. At the end of my testimony, the room was galvanized, and the first member of the panel, Professor Lee, from Toronto, I believe he was. Anyway, he is from Canada. He gave the first comment, and he said that was an absolutely stunning presentation. Why don't we know about this yet? So I'm just giving you kind of the tip of the iceberg. It was extremely successful, and I personally believe that depending upon the report, which is still to come out, it's being written, I believe that it has a great potential to be a genuine turning point worldwide for our movement. So that's my comment.
Thank you, Barbara. Paul, would you like to give your summary?
Well, I will say less. Because actually I had to go to, I had class the day before, so I couldn't go the first day, I couldn't go the last day, and I missed the last two sessions of the third day. So therefore, maybe you'd say I saw about 45% of everything, but including Barbara's, okay? I am not as enthusiastic. I'm not saying I'm not dumping on it either, but I'm not as enthusiastic as Barbara is. It is true that Barbara did a very excellent job, and it is true, at least from my point of view, that she should have gotten the same amount of time as the rest of us. For example, Chandler's talk I thought was rather trivial. I studied physics in college. I thought I could have given Chandler's talk by myself. I didn't really need to hear what he said. I mean, I'm not trying to put him down too much here, but it wasn't that. Barbara had much more to say than what Chandler said, so if they had reversed the two times for those two, it would have been better. But nevertheless, what I want to say is that there were some weaknesses from my point of view in the Toronto hearings. Basically, the weakness was that the decision about who would make presentations was only done by the steering committee, and that left out, for example, CIT. Which means that they were leaving out anything that was really controversial, and I just don't agree with that. I mean, and I think a better way to have handled it would have been to have, let's say, at least a half a day set aside to people who wanted to make a presentation, who had credentials, and were invited to make proposals, which the panelists could then decide whether to include or exclude, independent of what the steering committee said. I said that to the steering committee ahead of time, and I know that, you know, they weren't going to accept it and anything like that. But I'm just trying to say that, it was a good event, I think, but it wasn't that spectacular. I guess, just from my own point of view, I should say that I also have got very high compliments about what I particularly did, but I was doing insider trading, which is perhaps not as dramatic as what happened at the Pentagon. But anyway, I'll just make that comment. I don't think I really ought to say more because I wasn't there the whole time.
Thank you, Paul. Would anybody else like to make a comment about the Toronto hearings before we move on?
Yeah, it's Barry Zwicker in Toronto. I attended even less of the Toronto hearings, although I was qualified and invited to attend all of them. But because I chose to initiate a separate and independent and non-hostile event on the same weekend, namely on the evening of September 11th, an event at the Royal Cinema, at which two CIT members spoke, and it was a very successful thing too. More than 200 people were there, and as I say, it was not against the Toronto hearings. It was independent and supplementary, if you will. But because I was so involved in those preparations for that Sunday evening event, I ended up only being present at the first half of the first day of the Toronto hearings. And I must say that that first half of the first day was really good. I mean, DeWitt was excellent. Michael Kiefer was excellent. And I have viewed Barbara's on a part of Barbara's when it was live streaming, and it was pretty good too. And but the problems which I myself was obliged to observe prior to the hearings because of my close and long association with Graham McQueen, one of the three key leaders of the Toronto hearings. And Graham and I go back to well before 9/11. And so I felt that, and still do, that there were serious problems in the structure and the processes of the hearings. And the reason it matters is because I believe that they intend to use them as a basis for future such hearings. And the problems are, A, that they took non-controversiality as one of the three prime criteria for what subjects would be addressed or who would address them. And Graham and I had an extensive and very civil back and forth about that, and we just had to agree to disagree. The second thing is that the structure was such, as I think Paul alluded to, that it wasn't really as democratic as it could have been and should have been. The steering committee, I think, did too much steering, and I'd like to see a more open democratic process for deciding the criteria for future such hearings as to topic, and also for deciding whom would be invited to address future hearings. So I hope that may be somewhat useful, and certainly it was obvious that CIT was excluded from early on. Once I learned that definitely from Graham at a personal and friendly meeting, I said, you know what, I've got to do something so CIT can be in Toronto the same weekend, and it went ahead and didn't cause any trouble.
Thank you for doing that, Barry.
Ken Freeland, I'd like to ask you a quick question, Barry. Was there much crossover attendance between the two conferences?
Well, regrettably, there was not. Now, when I was at the Thursday morning session, I spoke with several people. I sat beside David Ray Griffin. We had a great chat, and he said he was going to try to go. Richard B. Lee definitely said he'd go to the CIT event, but it ended up he couldn't because the four commissioners, I believe, met post the final session of the Toronto hearing, which is very understandable, but that meant that they couldn't go. I believe there was at least one person at the CIT event who had been from the hearings. I forget his name. He was from Silver Springs, Maryland. Also, Senator Gravel was there. I was very pleased that he attended. But I don't know how much other crossover there was, much less than we had hoped, because, of course, there was an open invitation to everybody, and it was very affordable to be able to go to our event. It was $15.
Yeah. Any other comments or questions on this topic before we move on to the next one?
Yeah, I just wanted to add, seeing it's Barry, and I'm so glad Barry put on that event. Barry, I wanted to be at it so badly that I was invited to give the opening address the next morning at the INN World Report Conference in New York, and I couldn't. I was on a plane. But in any case, I did want people to know that although, of course, as a speaker, I was not privy to most of the deliberations of the steering committee or whoever ended up making the decision, if that was even an extended group beyond them, plus 5 members of the steering committee. However, I do know this from a number of members of the steering committee and from talking to the individuals involved. The steering committee did go out of their way to try to get pilots. And as fate would have it, none of them could come for legitimate reasons. They wanted Bob Bowman to talk about the lack of NORAD response and anything else he wanted about the planes, and Bob Bowman was very ill, and his doctor wouldn't release him to go. We all need to pray for Bob. They asked Captain Ted Muga, former Top Gun Navy pilot, and he originally accepted, and then for health reasons could not go. And they asked Ralph Kolstad, who had actually flown Flight 77 and Flight 11, as I recall, those very routes and perhaps even the plane, and he could not go for some reason. And they kept trying. They were trying to have the pilots for 9/11 truth perspective more or less included, and it just didn't work. So a lot of people think that certain topics were excluded, and you know, from the inside, as much as I do know, I think that it's less the case than some people think. That's my comment.
Well, if I could just follow on that, I believe that's so, what you say, Barbara, that they did it. I knew they attempted to get Bob and Ted, and yet the unfortunate point is that CIT has so much solid evidence to provide for hearing of that type, and from the very beginning, it was decided not to invite them. And I confirmed that from the horse's mouth, and we know that Kevin Ryan has been most opposed, you know, most unfriendly, shall we say, to
yes,
CIT,
and
I also saw various correspondence and emails indicating that others were not so much Graham. But anyway, the omission of CIT was extremely serious, and if there were to be pilots, that would have been fine, but that would not excuse excluding CIT from very early on without adequate reason.
Can I ask a question, Barry? You could have addressed, in other words, you don't have to ask someone who's a top spokesman for an organization. For instance, they didn't ask the top guy, Balsamo, from Pilots. They asked other people who were members of Pilots, and they couldn't come. So they wouldn't have to necessarily ask particular founders of an organization. You could have, for instance, given the set perspective and data. Did they ask you?
No, they did not. that was an early decision too, which there's no ego involvement in my response to that, although various people expressed great surprise that I wasn't asked to.
I do, and so I think you've addressed the gist of my question, which is it sounds like they were excluding the content of the information, not individuals.
Yeah, well, they were excluding both.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, thank you. I think we should move on there to have enough time to talk about the other two.
Have one important thing to mention, Barbara, and that is that for reasons that are really not clear, and I'm trying to get them addressed as a person who gave testimony, and that is that when you go to the website, the Toronto Hearings, www.torontohearings.org, or no, Toronto911hearings.org, and you click on the menu item, schedules and live streaming, and then click on that first link. There's not only the big screen on the left that gives the last portion of the last of the 4 days, but on the right, there are small thumbnails of some of the presentations, but only some of the presentations, and not even maybe a third at the most of the, maybe not even a third of the presentation. Surely in almost 2 months they could have had all of the presentations online, and that is very strange to me, and I'm trying to get it addressed. My own presentation is online in two different places. I will send people the links to that no later than tomorrow so that you can see them. But those were taken by amateur videographers. So I just wanted to make that point. If anyone knows anyone from the Toronto hearings, Barry, you would be an example. It would be great to ask Graham McLean, you know, please get all of the videotapes of all of the presentations up as soon as possible.
Yes,
this is Jeff Freeland. Isn't it the case that they intended or stated an intention to have a complete video of the entire proceedings available at some point?
Well, yes, but I'm talking about online. You know, some of those were up within less than 24 hours, and they've been up ever since. It's been almost 2 months. They should put them all up online. They are doing an edited version, and they claim a raw version. But not putting them all up online is a tremendous glaring hole that really needs to be addressed now.
Yeah. True.
Good point.
Okay. Good point. Yes, excellent point.
Ken, could I add something here? This is Sheila Casey.
Sheila, make it quick, please. We've got to move on. Go ahead.
I think that if what Barry is saying is correct, that this is meant to be a template, the Toronto hearings are meant to be a template for future hearings, that this is really something to be concerned about, because what we're looking at is a group of people getting together who, yes, they do want to make the point that the government lied. However, if we're heading towards a new investigation, we need more than just the government lied. We need evidence that can be used to try and convict certain individuals and put them behind bars. And I think what we're looking at is a template that is going to be a setup for a whitewash, a setup for evidence that is not going to be able to be used to actually try and convict certain individuals. I can't see any other reason why they would be so deliberately excluding CIT. And it's not as if they're neutral about CIT. Certain of those people, such as Chandler and Cole, have gone out of their way to tell lies. These people have lied, and I feel no compunction at all about using that word, because I've looked at the evidence. They've lied about CIT and what they say and who they are. And I do not consider these people to be real truthers. I do not consider Kevin Ryan to be a real truther. He has done too much that is too harmful to the movement. So I find it very alarming when these kinds of things are pulled together and everyone kind of congratulates each other and pats each other on the back and saying, aren't we grand? And here we are, the, you know, the creme de la creme of the truth movement. And I kind of say bah humbug to all that, because these are many people who have, in my mind, no credibility whatsoever.
Let's give Sheila the last word on that, because in fairness to the others that have things to discuss tonight, we really need to move on. Okay, we can come back to this for general discussion afterwards.
Hey, Ken, I want to interject about the roll call. There's been a lot of people who joined the call since I did the roll call. So
yes, okay. Sheila is one. Anybody besides Sheila new to the call that we didn't get on the initial roll call?
I thought I'd just go down the list, and anyone not on the, if they wouldn't mind just letting us know. I'll just do first names. Anna, Ken, Dwayne, Craig, Barbara, Ken Jenkins, Barry, Jeffrey, Don, Shelton, Susan, Mike, Paul, and Sheila. Anyone else on the call that I haven't called?
Thank you. Okay. Our next topic for discussion was requested by Paul. It has all to do with David Ray Griffin,
The first part of it would be the consensus used by the consensus panel as founded by David Ray Griffin and Elizabeth Woodward, and then moving on to specific chapters of his book, which I would suppose Paul would like to give a critique of. So, Paul, if you want to start us off, and then we can develop it into a discussion. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, let me just say you only have 10 minutes for this. I'm just simply not enough time. So let me focus on the first one. I think the first one is urgent. I mean, the issue about the consensus strategy of the consensus panel. Now, I'm speaking as a person who is a member of the panel, but I didn't quite know what the ball game was until after it came out. I mean, well, I knew some of it. But anyway, the consensus works out of, first of all, we have to discuss the idea of whether we even want a consensus, whether that's the best way forward. Secondly, I think we need to discuss whether the methodology of this particular consensus is worth sustaining or worth supporting. The consensus uses something called the Delphi method. The Delphi method was apparently developed in a military environment by the RAND Corporation in 1948. And I don't know, I mean, I haven't studied it enough to have a really informed opinion about it, but there are some charges about it that it has manipulative consequences. In other words, you can set up a Delphi a strategy which gets consequences that you want to achieve. Now, I'm not accusing anybody of doing that, but I think the Delphi method hasn't been discussed even among, well, I know it hasn't been discussed among the panelists. It's just been told to us that that's the way to move forward. If anybody in this conference call knows anything about the Delphi method or about consensus procedures, I would really like to hear about it because I would like to be more informed about the whole thing. I think that's all I want to say for the moment.
This is Barbara. I have a personal experience input on that with David Ray Griffin and Elizabeth Woodward. When I was in Toronto, Elizabeth and David came to dinner at the home of the hostess and host where I was staying. And there was an extended, also Neil Tarrant and his wife, and there was an extended conversation about the consensus project for at least an hour over dinner. And the reason is that Elizabeth and David were trying to decide whether to announce the results. They had already written up a press release, and whether to put it out over PR Newswire and announce it at the hearings on the last day of the Toronto hearings or not. And their first thought was not to, and then the thought was to, because all of the rest of us at the table and anyone else they asked said, of course put it out. This is the perfect time. You have all of these people here at the hearing. So they did decide to, as I recall, announce it on the last day of the hearings, and Elizabeth did have the press release come out on, I believe it was the last day of the hearing, September 11th. Well, what I learned is that, and this is almost a meta way to address what Paul just raised, even beyond the question about the Delphi method being able to be steered effectively, like any poll, basically, it depends upon the questions that are asked and how they are asked. And the big question is, who came up with the potential consensus statements that were then voted on by the 20 or so members of the consensus panel? And as far as I can understand it, the basic answer is David Ray Griffin working with Elizabeth Woodward. So you have people. Now, David is wonderful. I love David. But I think that there should have been far more democratic input from the movement as to what those consensus statements should have been to begin with. So I see a real glaring problem with it. And, I mean, David doesn't make any, he doesn't try to hide the fact that for a very long time he personally tried to steer the movement towards simply focusing on the World Trade Centers, and especially over the last year especially World Trade Center 7. But he's now gone beyond that. He's actually explicitly stated that he feels that the Pentagon it should be a major focus now. But I think that it's the important thing is that there was not a democratic input or any way to vote on the consensus statements that in turn were presented to this Delphi method, to the panelists, whoever they were.
And I'd like to follow, Barry in Toronto here, I'd like to follow up on what Barbara has said by way of agreement with her, number one. But I think that it's not enough to say it depends on the questions asked. It depends also on the persons chosen to be on the panel. And one only needs to think of the importance of, say, appointments to the Supreme Court or the appointments to various investigative commissions to see that the personnel are absolutely key. And if you just choose the right people, you'll just get the result you want. And the fact is, I was invited to be part of the panel and did participate. In fact, I was enthusiastic about it. I was cooperative. And I offered quite a number of points, I think most of which did find their way into the final points. But I thought at the end of the process, when I realized that the fact that I didn't know who the others were meant that it was not an authentic consensus, I actually felt duped. And here's what I mean. Consensus is terrific, but only after there's been thorough discussion. Now, thorough discussion means, if possible, face-to-face discussion as at a town meeting, or at least something as close as possible to everybody knowing in a transparent way who are the other people involved in the discussion. I mean, if you're face-to-face, body language means a lot, tone of voice, so on. You want to know the background of the people. And the fact is, if you have a panel and everyone is unknown to the others, and that's how it was set up, I don't know why I went along with it to begin with, if there are ringers in there, and then they can, you know, inauthentic people, then of course the whole process becomes compromised. And I regret to say that that's what I believe happened. Now, the consensus panel process is proceeding, and it will be slightly improved. But some of us involved really have to review the extent to which we want to be involved, or whether we want to be involved at all.
But Barry, do we know who the consensus panelists are now? Are they public?
Oh yes.
This is Shelton. It's on the website, and I'm one of them.
Yeah.
And I agree completely with what Barry just said. I felt a little bit taken advantage of, I guess, when I found out what the end result was going to be. Strenuously objected a couple of times during the process to the kind of the blindness of the panel to the process and to what was coming out of it. And I'm glad to see it's continuing, because we may be able to work on some of those issues, but I too question seriously the value of a consensus arrived at by that method.
This is Dwayne. If I go ahead. I'm also a panel member, and I know something about Delphi method, and my feeling is that we're not implementing it the way it typically would be implemented for the kind of task that we're being asked to do. I don't know for that for sure, but I have a feeling that's the case. I do know one thing about the Delphi method is it's attempted to structure it such that, let's say, a panel member with a strong personality, more authoritative, I guess, kind of gets leveled out a little bit, does not have the same authority if the other panel members don't know who it is. And I think that's what they're trying to do, is to keep that aspect of it, which I find very frustrating. I do feel like there should be a means of discussing the topics between the panel members, and the way it's being implemented there is no discussion, particularly if someone feels negative towards a issue. I would very much like to hear what their reasons are, and that is not part of the process the way it's being implemented.
Jeffrey here.
Was that Dwayne speaking?
Yes, it's Dwayne.
Okay, thank you.
Jeffrey here.
Yeah. Go ahead, Jeffrey.
Yeah, I'd like to make a comment on both the consensus the process that took place and the Toronto hearings. I'm associated with a bunch of people that have a website called the 9/11 Free Forums. And many of the people there, or several of the people there, are very conscientious, rigorous scientists. There's a lot of background noise someplace. And what struck me as very odd about both of these processes, that not one person or notice was put up at the 9/11 Free Forums inviting any of these scientists or engineers to participate. And several of these people are doing stellar research and engineering and physics and chemistry and so on and so forth. And it's almost as if these people, their work is like invisible to the 9/11 truth movement. And that strikes me as very unusual. I know Dwayne knows the website. I wonder if he might want to comment on it.
Well, I would say yes. I'm impressed with the quality of several of the regulars there at the forum, but I don't see them showing up in any other kind of 9/11 truth activity. Over.
It's Barbara.
Do you think they should be asked to participate? I mean, you know, if you're talking about like somebody like a David Chandler, who's a physicist, or some of the people at the 9/11 Free Forums, which, you know, tower over David Chandler. It's sort of strange.
I guess this is Dwayne again. I would say the whole question of how do you expand the panel members, I don't know how that should be pursued. For example, would any new panel member have to agree with all of the statements that have already been issued, or could they have an opportunity to object? That's just a question that comes to mind. I don't know that there's any thought about adding panel members, but anyway, there's all kinds of questions. Over.
Sorry.
Okay, Barbara, did you want to make a comment here?
Yeah, a quick comment. This is a gut feeling. All of the very legitimate critiques that all of us have for what I really believe is a very well-meaning effort, a very difficult and time-consuming effort, the consensus project, and you know, you always have to get bugs out of things, and I know David Ray Griffin has told me personally that they're going to do another round, and they hope to do many more rounds. So there is opportunity to input ideas to him and others, but both in terms of the selection of the consensus statement to be placed before the consensus panelists, as well as the steering committee at the Toronto hearing, who they invited, who they didn't invite, and just glaringly the straitjacket that was put on me as the only 100% Pentagon speaker, that what I could not talk about, or I couldn't talk at all. You have a, and I was willing to do it because I got a tremendous amount of factual information that stunned the judges out in by agreeing to this limitation, and it was a trade-off that I decided to make for the movement. However, my gut feeling is that all of these taken together, there is a, if you will, a hidden consensus by a group of influential individuals in the movement to, as the best word I can come up with, is contain the direction of those statements that are legitimized in the eyes of a future hopeful 9/11 new investigation. And I think that that's wrong. I agree with everyone that that is wrong. However, as they say, there's freedom of the press if you have a press, and there is freedom of you know, who you invite to a consensus project or who you invite to a hearing if you run those hearings. So maybe what we're really saying is we have to do it better, and we have to do it again, and we have to do it ourselves.
It's Craig McKee. Can I jump in at some point?
Yeah, Craig, and then let's we need to allow time for the last item on our discussion. So if everybody's okay with this, let's give Craig the last word and then move on to the last topic.
Yeah, I guess there are a few things that really concern me about this consensus thing. I mean, when you look at the website right now, and there is a really good group of people there, including several people on the call, but the evidence that's listed, especially for the Pentagon, there's only one item listed, and that is as to the piloting skills of Hani Hanjour and how unlikely it is that he could have made the maneuver that would have to have been made. It concerns me that anybody looking at that website and looking for Pentagon evidence is going to think that all the people on that panel are basically only able to agree on that as being strong evidence. And this, I think, is a real problem. You know, it's almost worse than having the whole Pentagon ignored completely. I'd almost rather that than to have this one little item sitting there. It just looks like that there's no strong evidence at all. The other thing is that I believe, if I'm not mistaken, I read on the website that it's a 90% agreement is required for an item to be on that list, which...
It's 85%.
Okay, I read somewhere 90, but okay. Now, if you have 22 members, which I think is what the last I checked, there were 22, well, based on the 90, I don't know if it's 85, but that only requires 3 people to oppose something, to get it off the list. And I think that's a problem, too, because all you need is 3 people that have, you know, their own agenda to keep certain stuff off, and it's not hard to do, you know. So I'm just concerned, and I'm wondering about some of the people on part of this group who are still on there, you know, whether there's something that, or a point beyond which they might, you know, find it counterproductive to be, to have their name on it. Anyway. So,
who is speaking now? Who is this?
That's Craig McKee speaking.
Okay, thanks, Craig.
Thank you, Craig. Okay.
And the other, just to throw on at the end here, if I can really quickly, the fact that sure. Barbara was told not to mention the plane, that's kind of alarming to me, too. I realize that wasn't the subject of her presentation, but just the fact that would be specified is kind of alarming.
I wasn't going to be clear about that. I wanted to. I wasn't allowed to.
Yeah, no, that's exactly what I meant. That's what's it's the fact that you weren't allowed to that kind of alarms me. And particularly in combination with the fact that David Ray Griffin's presentation on the Pentagon, he was almost exclusively just quoting Chandler, Cole, and Legge. Like, they, you know, all the things they thought about the Pentagon. He hardly even sort of gave his own opinion about anything. It was all based on them. Fortunately, the chapter in his book that talks about the Pentagon, he went well beyond that to sort of shoot down some of their arguments. But anyway, so I just throw that in at the end there. So that's good for me.
Okay, thank you, Craig.
Can I say something for just 15 seconds?
Yeah, 15 seconds. Go ahead, Barbara.
Okay, this is Sheila. All I wanted to say is that this just confirms what I believe, which is that our opposition, the perpetrators, to them, the most thing that they are most frightened of is the evidence that the plane crash at the Pentagon was faked. That scares them more than anything else. I do agree that Barbara's evidence about the bombs in the building is important, but evidently that does not scare them as much as the evidence of a faked plane crash.
Yeah.
Well,
okay.
Seeing
Thank
as
you.
My name was brought up, I do think that my evidence does scare them, and I think that it was a small miracle that it was allowed in. And, you know, I could go into how that happened, but it really was tremendously synchronistic. I did want to address the planes I wasn't allowed to, but I do think that in the future, I do know, just for the record, that Graham McQueen was the one who was open to doing so, that I know of.
Okay. I know this is a very fruitful topic, and it's a topic of continued interest, and we'll be discussing it again. So I'd like to ask that we move on in the interest of the last topic that I think was requested by Robin Forden, but Robin's not on the call, concerning the engaging the U.S. military in the 9/11 truth-seeking community. And he particularly asked if Shelton give his thoughts about engaging the U.S. military in the community. So, Shelton, if you care to make a comment, then we could open it up.
I'd say the military community is pretty well represented in terms of retired people, but I have yet to see, at least in the officer corps, a lot of visible association with 9/11. That's probably understandable. Been out of the Marine Corps since 1984, so I've lost touch with everybody on you duty. I currently own the website for Military Officers 9/11 Truth that was formed with the assistance of Woodworth and Dr. Griffin. But a membership is not a membership. It's a list of signatories on Miller's website, Question 9/11, that were that are mostly former military. They're all former military, and I don't have contact. Not been able to get up with Alan Miller. I've tried numerous. I don't have his contact information. Help in that regard, I'd appreciate it. That's kind of the status right now. In terms of military on active duty, there is no presence that I'm aware of.
Okay. Thank you, Chelsea. Anybody else have any comments on that?
Well, perhaps we could raise it again when Robin's on.
Yeah, it's too bad that Robin's not here, because I think he had certain questions that he wanted to pursue in regard to that. He had made some reference to Barbara's earlier comments about the 9/11 attacks, war game scenario, and so forth that he wanted to pursue. But maybe we should postpone this topic until Robin can be here to ask his own questions. I would like to say, in reference to the military officers who question 9/11 truth, we are in the process of trying to set up a linkages page on the Citizens 9/11 Commission homepage, and any major linkages of that sort, I would appreciate if anybody with any suggestions on what linkages we should be making, please send them to me directly. And we'll make sure that we include them, because we want to set up a master list of, you know, major 9/11 truth testimonies from different aspects of the movement, you know, like military officers, lawyers, so forth and so on, each one that has its own component. We want to get all those links up there. So any suggestions on that, please email to me.
Ken, this is
Sheldon. Yes, Sheldon.
Yeah, there is a Facebook group. I have not been able to find out who is in charge of it. But there's military officers around, and put that up on Facebook.
Okay.
There's also law
enforcement. That's a whole other ballgame, yeah.
There's also law enforcement, the 9/11 truth, which links to an idea that we need to build movements as well. The Oath Keepers, I think, is a very important group that we need to poll to see where they are on 9/11 truth, because there are a lot of military in the Oath Keepers as well.
Good point. Any other comments about the military, engaging the military in our movement?
Well, it's Barbara. Having worked for the Navy for 15 years, I think we really should pursue this, as I said, when Robin's on, maybe in the next call, make sure that he's on the next call. But I did have a question for Shelton. And Shelton, right after 9/11, I'm sure you're aware of it, there was a guy by the name of, I think his name was Colonel Grand Prix, who put together a meeting at Fort Belvoir of pretty high-ranking current and former military officers to address what really happened on 9/11. And they sent a letter to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And they claimed that one of the two of them, either Myers or Peter Pace, made 500 copies and sent it all over the Pentagon into the White House and such. Do you know who those people were who were at that meeting at Fort Belvoir, and are they in your group?
I have no idea. All I know of Colonel Grand Prix was the blurb on him and Alan Miller's site.
Right.
He is not
okay,
a member.
So the simple answer is no. I'm working on getting those names for you.
Good. Uh-huh. I was going to say that Barbara might be in a better position to come up with contacts because of her recent work experience in the military environment.
Well, actually, I wish I were. I'm a civilian, and I'm no longer working for the military. And, you know, my work in 9/11 makes me a persona non grata for anybody who's there. I mean, it was a small miracle they let me in the gate for 10 years. So I wish it were the case, you know, no more than anyone else, I don't think.
Okay. Any other comments on that particular topic? If there aren't, in deference to our secretary, whose time is limited, I'd like to formally adjourn the meeting. But if anybody would care to stay on for a formal discussion, they're welcome to do so. We can keep the call open as long as people want to stay on, okay? Thank you all for your cooperation tonight. Our next meeting will be the last Wednesday of November. So we'll see you all back here at the same time, same place.
Good night, and thank you.
Thanks, right. Ken.
Thank you.
Very good, Ken.
Thank you. Good night.
Thanks, Anna. Is anybody left?
I'm here.
Yeah.
Oh, Craig. Yeah, the hardcore is left.
Craig, I'm glad you're here.